to Acts chapter 18. They say that there's two main symbols of our Christian experience. One is a yoke and one is the cross. The cross speaks of leaving the world for Christ. The yoke speaks of learning in the world from Christ. One is speaking of sacrifice, that's the cross, but the yoke represents service unto Him. Last week we talked a little bit about the cross and had the privilege, both second and third service. People give their lives to Christ for the first time, and getting to talk with them a little bit afterwards and talking about the Christ. Talking about the cross. This week in chapter 18, we're going to talk more about the yoke. And one of the aspects of service is making disciples. And so what I'd like to do is run through our chapter as kind of a running commentary, talk about here's what's going on. And so running quickly through the observation interpretation part, really getting to the application of what I see happening here is an incredible process of discipleship that we really need to emulate. And some real practical things at the very end of it of how we each can do that. We should be doing it, and hopefully a real practical way where at the end you could say, I could do that. And hopefully that will start that process. So let's jump into chapter 18 and verse 1. He just left Athens and heading towards Corinth. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius, he was the emperor of the day, had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome, and he came to them. So because he was of the same trade, that would be Paul, he's in the same trade of Aquila and Priscilla, he stayed with them and worked, for by occupation they were tent makers or leather workers. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. And when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. But when they opposed him and blasphemed, he shook his garments and said to them, "Your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And so he's kind of quoting from Ezekiel there. And he departed from there and entered the house of a certain man named Justus, one who worshipped God, whose house was next door to the synagogue. Then Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all of his household. And many of the Corinthians hearing believed and were baptized. So great revival in the city of Corinth. Now, the Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision. "Do not be afraid, but speak and do not keep silent. For I am with you and no one will attack you to hurt you. And I have many people in this city." And he continued there a year and 6 months teaching the word of God among them. Kelly and I started dating just out of high school, and we had gone up to see her sister up in the San Francisco area. And we were to meet her downtown, so she told us how to get on this bus and go down to the downtown area. Again, we're fresh out of high school, and we're there with Kelly and her best friend Julie. And we get off this bus and didn't realize something. It was the very beginning, as we got on the street corner, the beginning of the Gay Pride Parade. We had never seen anything like this before. And there's too many things that we saw that I can't even repeat what we saw. But all of a sudden, our eyes must have just been as big as Frisbees, just seeing all that was going on as we were, as we stepped off the bus in this foreign land. When Paul got to Corinth, it must have been the same way. He just came from Athens up north a little bit in Greece. There it was all about the intellect and the Grecian culture and all of that. And as they go down to the southern part of Greece now and step into Corinth with Paul stepping off the bus, I think his eyes were just as big in what he just stepped into. For on the hill that called the Acropolis, there was the temple of Aphrodite, where there was always a minimum of 1,000 temple prostitutes. That was part of their religion that would come out at nighttime to ply their trade. And so the Greeks, here in Corinth is a city within Greece, and the Greeks came up with this verb, or they used this verb, to Corinthianize, meant to fornicate or to live a life of debauchery. And so they would even use the term. And so when they would look at the people in Corinth, they would be looking down upon them. If you have the mainland of Greece, it goes down into a tiny isthmus, 3.5 miles wide, and then it opens up again into the southernmost part of Greece. And right at that isthmus there is where the city of Corinth is. It was a very wealthy city because it had then two ports, one on the east side and one on the west side. And so there's two different seas, and it would save people from going 200 miles all the way around to the other side. They would a lot of times transport smaller ships and stuff right across the isthmus there. And so with that, any city that had two ports, it was just incredible for commerce and everything else that was going on. Something else that made them very popular. What's going to happen on 8-8-08? What happens? Kelly put her up her hands. We look forward to the Olympics. We love the Olympic Games. Well, the Olympic Games came from the Isthmian Games. The Isthmian Games were from the Isthmus of Corinth. And so in that isthmus, that's where they would put these on. Every 2 years, they'd have chariot rides and races and all the different things. And so every 2 years, people from all over the region coming there for this sporting event. 200,000 people in this area of Corinth. But as I said, you kind of get a vibe or a feel of what was going on there. And yet, only a handful of people saved up in the intellectual zone of Athens, and there's a ton of people getting saved, even the head guy of the synagogue and his whole family. And so some great things, great churches planted there in Corinth, and some neat things happening. Paul's going to spend, as it said in verse 11, a year and a half there. Normally he's going out being the upfront frontier guy, church planting and doing that, but he stays here to disciple for a year and a half. In that time period, he writes 1 and 2 Thessalonians. Throughout the book of Acts, he writes 10 of his epistles. He meets up with this Aquila and Priscilla. Didn't know them before. But he meets them, find out they're the same trade. They invite him to come live in their home. And there he develops this incredible relationship and then discipleship relationship with them. And they were both tent makers, it says, in the Greek, cloth workers. It was a coarse fabric taken from goat's hair from up in the region Paul came from, Cilicia. And they would make everything from curtains, rugs, clothing, and these tents made out of this goat hair. And that's what they did for a living. Sorry, I'm having problems with my microphone here. Finally, in verse 5, we have Silas and Timothy showing up. Remember when he went to Athens, he says, come quickly. Well, they never made it. And so he's down in Corinth now, and they finally show up. And Philippians lets us know that they brought some finances with them. So this is a time in his life where he's dealing with some fears. He's dealing with lack of finances. He's dealing with a number of different things. And I believe that's why God shows up. Jesus shows up to him in the night watch in verse 9 to be able to remind him, Paul, I'm with you. What a great word of encouragement that is. First of all, we'll say about verse 9, when the Lord shows up, he says, do not be afraid. Now, whenever they would show up, that means because you are. And so here's Paul having different fears in this town. There's some political things that we're going to deal with in a minute that are nipping at his heels and a number of things. But whatever all his fears were, it seems that fears seem to haunt you the best at nighttime, maybe because it's just quiet and everybody else is asleep and your mind has time just to spin and to think. But what are your late night fears lately? How does God want to speak to your heart? Well, I think what he wants to say is the very first thing is do not be afraid. And the reasoning behind it is because for I'm with you. That great verse is found where God speaks it to Isaac and then Jeremiah. And Jacob and the Jews when they get back from Babylon and the Jews while they're building the temple. And then Jesus says it to you and I in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 20, the reminder of I'm with you. Well, he said right after that, and no one will attack you to hurt you. He meant in Corinth right there because he had already said in chapter 9, oh yeah, by the way, I need to let you know of the sufferings that you're going to endure. So it doesn't mean that the rest of his life no one ever is going to touch Paul. No, we're going to read later that they do touch him in a lot of different ways, beat him and everything else. But as he's there in Corinth, he's saying, relax. Don't be afraid. I do want you to speak and share the things of me. Continue to go forward. No one's going to hurt you here. And as he said in verse 7, for I have many people in the city. That wasn't a, I got many people here, you know, kind of thing. That's not what it was, you know, to protect you. What he was saying is, I got a lot of souls to be saved here. And it happened. And he got to see the fruit of what had taken place. And look at 12 verses 12 through 17. When Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat, saying, "This fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." When Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, O Jews, there'd be reason why I should bear with you. But if it's a question of words and names and your own law, look to it yourselves, for I do not want to be a judge of such matters." And he drove them from the judgment seat. Then all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat. But Gallio took no notice of these things. What's going on here? Well, we catch a real important vibe of what's happening between Romans and Greeks and Jews and Christians and all of this taking place. Here's kind of what's up. First of all, it's anti-Semitism of the day in verse 17 there, of beating up on the Sosthenes, the new ruler of the synagogue there, as they beat him up, and it just shows that Gallio really didn't matter what they were doing with him at the time. But what was happening here? The Jews had just come up with what was called the imperial cult. It was at a time where Rome was shifting into a place where all of a sudden the emperor was now being deified. And everyone in the Roman kingdom was expected to worship the emperor as a god. Now, within Judaism, being already existing and realizing that they're monotheists, they can only believe in one God, they were basically stamped or sanctioned that it was okay for the Jews not to worship the emperor because of their religion. And so they were okay. So what the Jews are trying to do is they chased him out of Thessalonica and then chased him out of Berea. Didn't catch up with them in Athens, but they're showing up here again and causing the pain and the pressure here. What they want to do is they want the Romans to say, hey, they're monotheists too, the Christians are. And so get them to bow down to your emperor. They're breaking Roman law. That's the issue. This is a historic decision. This is unprecedented. What is happening here on the way Gallio responds to all of this. Now, the reason he responds to this is, in Judaism, they had this religio licta, that they were a legitimate religion, basically. And what the Jews are trying to make it is an illegitimate one, and he really doesn't want to give it the time of day. Gallio, he couldn't understand all their theological nuances. Just as if I brought up this morning some Sunni and some Shiite Muslims and asked you to give judgment on one of their theological issues. You're going, they're all Muslims. So I don't know the difference. Who cares? That was what Gallio was saying here. He's going, you know what? Christianity, here's the important part. Christianity is simply, they're Messianic Jews. That's how they saw them. They're simply Jews that believed in the Savior. And that first century, that's pretty much what it was. Now they're in the land of Greece, and now more Greeks are getting saved in that. But it's mostly Jews that were saved in that first century. And so with that, they just saw it as a sect or a branch of Judaism. And so what's happening here is Christianity is stamped okay. Paul can continue to share the gospel and do what they're doing because he just saw it as a branch of Judaism. That's exactly the opposite of what the Jews are trying to do. They're trying to have the Romans say, no, they're a complete different, whole different work, you know, condemn them. That it wouldn't happen. Well, unfortunately, it only buys them about 10 to 12 years of protection. For after that, the emperors start hitting hard and strong for 200 years and did the most vile things to Christians throughout those next 10 emperors of Rome until Rome ends up seeing its demise. Just indescribable atrocities of what they do. Nero, for one, if you heard stories about him, real whacked, crazy guy. But he would strip Christians and put them in his garden and put them on big giant stakes, put them on the stakes, put pitch and tar all over him and light him on fire to light his gardens at night. I mean, he was just a real demented guy, and a lot of the emperors were of the day. So for the next 200 years, but for right now, for these 10 years, next 10 to 12 years, they're okay because of this edict by Gallio here. So again, we might just read past something, but that was just precedent for the times in Corinth and that area and that region. It was a very important decision there. Verse 18, so Paul still remained a good while. Then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. He had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow. And he came to Ephesus and left them there. But he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. And when they had asked him to stay a longer time with them, he did not consent, but took leave of them, saying, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem, but I'll return again to you, God willing, and sail. And he sailed from Ephesus. And when he had landed at Caesarea and gone up and greeted the church, I'd have been down in Jerusalem, and he went to Antioch, so where he had started from. And after he had spent some time there, he departed and went over the region of Galatia and Phrygia in order strengthening all the disciples. In between verse 22 and 23 is his break between the end of his second journey. He makes it back to Antioch, his home church, and starts up his next journey in 3. So we don't hear a lot about his furlough and what had taken place at that time. But let's go up to verse 18 and ask, why the stop at the barber shop, and why do we need to hear that you got a haircut in Caesarea? Well, what happened was, by him getting his haircut and this aspect of a vow, takes us back to Numbers chapter 6, which wasn't something commanded the Israelite to do, the Jew to do, but instead it would be something that he would do out of a thankful heart. And so he would take this Nazirite vow, no drinking, no drinking wine, and they wouldn't cut their hair for a time. And so we have him, and again, just coming off of that, this Judeo-Christianity is still kind of a branch of Judaism. We definitely see aspects of that, of Paul is still a Jew and still doing these things. And so what it is, it's a Jewish ritual of thanksgiving. And Paul had a lot to be thankful about. And so he's kind of finishing his vow. He cuts off his hair. Something really interesting of what had happened at that time. Whenever you would have this vow, you would have to go down to the temple in Jerusalem to cut off your hair, and it would be burnt with one of the burnt sacrifices. That was a process. The Jews had just released Jews to do this in other places. And so it had just opened up to be able to cut your hair at another place, but that's why he says, I must go down to Jerusalem. He's actually taking his hair there to burn it on the burnt offering. So that's kind of some of the things that are happening kind of behind the scene there, and why it says that he got his hair cut in century as just some of the other things that were happening there. Let's read the last part, and then I want to step into discipleship. He says, now a certain Jew named Apollos, born at Alexandria, that's the top part of Africa there in Egypt, an eloquent man and mighty in the scriptures, came to Ephesus. This man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he spoke and taught accurately the things of the Lord, though he knew only the baptism of John. And so he began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Aquila and Priscilla heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. And when he desired to cross to Achaia, the brethren wrote, exhorting the disciples to receive him. And when he arrived, he greatly helped those who had believed through grace, for he vigorously refuted the Jews publicly, showing from the scriptures that Jesus is the Christ. We're going to talk about Apollos in a minute, but I'm going to take a step back now and look big picture. If you can keep a finger there, go to 2 Timothy 2:2. 2 Timothy, where's a 2:2? No. 2 Timothy 2:2. That's how you can remember where it is. This is actually a great, you might even take the word and put discipleship out in the margin there, because it really defines what a disciple does or how discipleship takes place. In verse 2 of 2 Timothy 2, and the things that you have heard from me, me being Paul, among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. It's a real simple thing. Paul carries this on to Timothy, tells Timothy to carry it on to faithful men or women, and then to carry that on to others. And so it's this fourfold process of carrying it on to others, which really isn't fourfold. It really just continues to go on and on and on and on. A very important aspect of discipleship is this multiplication. We picked as our motto for our church to live the great commandment and to fulfill the great commission. Fulfill the Great Commission is what? To make disciples. A lot of people think it means to go out and evangelize. That's not it. That's a very small part of discipleship. Discipleship really kicks off when the person gets saved. And then it's investing in their lives, and that's what we're going to talk more about. So we want to ask, okay, make disciples. How, Jesus? How are we supposed to do that? How practically does that take place? See, a lot of us, we've learned how to live a balanced life. We haven't perfected it yet, but we kind of get in the aspect of doing our devotions and praying, going to church and having Christian friends and being involved in missions. And you start developing this balanced life, but then what? what a lot of Christians done is locked it away in a vault rather than investing it in others. Take the things that you've learned now and invest in others. That's what's supposed to take place. Well, and we can go on back to Acts 18. That's what Paul does. He models this so beautifully here. And we're actually going to see a three-step process that he does. Now, normally we don't see Paul as that personal discipler type. We see him out on the front lines and plant churches and going where no man has gone before. But here's a place where he's settled down for 18 months and investing in the life of this great couple here. As I said, there's three steps. First step, get close to somebody. Second step, train them. Third step, multiply. It's pretty simple. Let's talk about the first step here, get close. Initiate a friendship. Work with them. He meets them. He ends up staying at their house. He ends up, they have a lot of similarities there because they work in the same trade. And so, what a great couple. We meet Aquila and Priscilla. Every time that they're mentioned, they're always together in Scripture. We always hear both of their names. They're very important workers to the New Testament church. Wherever they were, they had a church in their house. They came from Rome. They moved to Corinth. They go to Ephesus, and they'll end up back in Rome at some time. And at each of those places, we always hear that they had a home church going on. And so inviting people in, training them up, discipling them. And here's Paul to come alongside and help them. So here's this couple with heart and hands and their homes were given over to the Lord. In a discipleship relationship, the better we know one another is the better that our disciplee is going to understand how to deal with life problems. See, a lot of times we think of a book, and we're going to get to the book, and the book is important, the more the formal training, let's say, of doing